Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is, excuse me, it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And if it's not time, then I don't think there will ever be a time. So it must be time to make our, what do we call it? In our appeal to heaven. Because when all else fails, that's what we must do. So anyway, so if you've got your appeals going, then that's great. If not, if you need help, you want to get organized, or you want to just get with another organized group, let us know. I will also just final obligatory. Your campaign has already begun. It should have already began. And every day the ticks, you're getting another day behind. So the only way we're going to be able to be successful in unseating people is to literally use every day as a PR campaign to where the people become so nauseated hearing about how bad their public servants are that by the time the election comes up next year, they will be thankful to have an opportunity to get rid of them. That's what you have. That's what this whole PR campaign is about. And that's what petitions will do. Because if you use petitions, you will be proving to your public, to those people that will be voting, why they need to cast their vote somewhere else. And so there we go. Anyway, so we wrapped up in our last show, and it was kind of towards the very end, that we hit the, I'll just call it the Organic Act, but we didn't go through it completely. What we did was we just covered the first couple of paragraphs, just due to the fact that what it's doing was unconstitutionally creating, they were creating a state out of the District of Columbia. And they could not, nor could it ever be a state. It was supposed to be autonomous. It was supposed to be strictly under congressional rule. And so Congress wanted to try to ease their life. And actually, they were trying to create a Saito-like process, or literally create an institution that would eventually become a state. And today they recognize, or the District of Columbia is recognized with an electoral college. They don't have representation yet, but they're doing everything they can to try to become a state. And so we'll dive into this with the ratification base, why this became so unconstitutional. But more importantly, this was the foundation that they used to actually start doing what they wanted to do regarding corporations and so forth. So anyway, what we're doing now is we're now actually going to deal with the Great Britain Treaty of 1871, which is called the Washington Treaty. There's a few Washington treaties, but this particular treaty is the one that actually pulled a few states together. Now, I find it interesting that when we go through the list of states that will be a part of this treaty, Britain has really stacked its deck in its favor. And so, anyway, we'll dive into this, but what I want to do is I want to show you how and the language. And by the way, they're going to use a term or a word that is not very common, and every once in a while you will hear this word, and it's plenipotentiaries. And a plenipotentiary is the grand poobah, supposedly the person that has been granted all sufficient power to do whatever they're required to do. Does that make sense?
Plenipotentiary. Got it.
Okay. And so in this, they're creating this commission or this this committee that is going to hear the claims and try to resolve the claims of the Alabama claims. Let's go ahead and read this, and then we'll dive into the context of what this is all about. Okay. Go ahead.
The United States of America and Her Britannic Majesty being desirous to provide for an amiable settlement of all causes or differences between the two countries, have for that purpose appointed their respective plenipotentiaries, that is to say, the President of the United States has appointed, on the part of the United States, as commissioners in a joint high commission and plenipotentiaries, Hamilton Fish, Secretary of State, Robert Cummings Sheck, Envoy Extraordinary and Minister Plenipotentiary to Great Britain, Samuel Nelson, an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Ebenezer Rockwood Hoare, of Massachusetts, and George Henry Williams of Oregon, and Her Britannic Majesty, on her part, has appointed as her High Commissioners and Plenipotentiaries the Right Honorable George Frederick Samuel, Earl de Grey, and Earl of Ripon, Viscount Goderich, Baron Grantham, a Baronet, a Peer of the United Kingdom, Lord President of Her Majesty's Most Honorable Privy Council, Knight of the Most Noble Order of the Garter, etc., etc., the Right Honorable Sir Stafford Henry Northcote, Baronet, one of Her Majesty's Most Honorable Privy Council, a Member of the Parliament, a Companion of the Most Honorable Order of the Bath, etc., etc., Sir Edward.
Right.
Thornton. What were you going to say?
No, Sir Edward Norton, or Thornton, yeah.
Sir Edward Thornton. Okay, Sir Edward Thornton, Knight Commander of the Most Honorable Order of the Bath, Her Majesty's Envoy Extraordinary and Minister Plenipotentiary to the United States of America, Sir John Alexander MacDonald, Knight Commander of the Most Honorable Order of the Bath, a member of Her Majesty's Privy Council for Canada, and Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Her Majesty's Dominion of Canada, and Montague Bernard Esquire, I don't know how to say that. Chichel, Professor.
Go ahead.
Of International Law in the University of Oxford.
Okay, so this is who they have between Britain, Canada, and America. But technically, when you really look at all of the different, nations, I believe Brazil is also added to this. So there is Switzerland, Britain, Canada, the United States, and Brazil. And if I remember correctly, that's basically those five powers. And so in Article 1, they're going to talk about these Alabama claims. Now, the problem is that Britain wanted its compensation, and America made a counter claim that basically they were called the Alabama claims, and the about Alabama claims were basically disputes that United States had with Great Britain out of the Civil War because of the sinking of the ships, American ships, that were done by these British ships that were built for the South. So in other words, this is kind of like a side-oblique way of dealing with the compensation that the United States felt that they needed. To me, I see this as a smokescreen for what Britain was really trying to do, because Britain was trying to get compensated because the 14th Amendment denied them compensation because they were basically meddling in North America and they were supporting the rebellion against the Union. So that's kind of where we are. This is the treaty of doing this. So Article 1, let's go ahead.
Whereas differences have arisen between the government of the United States and the government of Her Britannic Majesty and still exist, growing out of the acts committed by the several vessels which have given rise to the claims generically known as the Alabama Claims. And whereas Her Britannic Majesty has authorized her high commissioners and plenipotentiaries to express in a friendly spirit the regret felt by Her Majesty's government for the escape under whatever circumstances of the Alabama and other vessels from British ports and for the depredations committed by those vessels. You want me to keep going?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Now, in order to remove and adjust all complaints and claims on the part of the United States and to provide for the speedy settlement of such claims which are not admitted by Her Britannic Majesty's government, the high contracting parties agree that all said claims growing out of acts committed by the aforesaid vessels and generically known as the Alabama Claims shall be referred to a tribunal of arbitration to be composed of 5 arbiters to be appointed in the following manner. That is to say, one shall be named by the President of the United States, one shall be named by Her Britannic Majesty, His Majesty, the King of Italy shall be requested to name one, President of the Swiss Confederation shall be requested to name one, and His Majesty of the Emperor of Brazil shall be requested to name one.
Okay, so right there we have the layout of the commission or the committee, that there are 3 from Europe, Italy, Swiss, and the Britain, and then the United States and Brazil. Now, I'm not sure if Brazil's going to be on our side or not, but anyway, okay, so now they're going to kind of go through, you know, what do you do? How are these arbiters going to behave? What happens in case of death? I mean, that's, you know, in case of death or absence or what have you. So we're going to kind of skip the rest of this. They're just laying this out now. And now with Article 2, it's going to identify that the arbiters shall meet in Geneva in Switzerland at the earliest convenience. Okay. And then in Article 3, let's take it, because this is a little more getting into the administration of what they're doing. So go ahead.
Okay. The written or printed case of each of the two parties accompanied by the documents, the official correspondence, and other evidence on which each relies shall be delivered in duplicate to each of the arbiters and to the agent of the other party as soon as may be after the organization of the tribunal, but within a period not exceeding 6 months from the date of the exchange of the ratifications of this treaty.
Okay, so now Article 4.
Within 4 months after delivery on both sides of the written or printed case, either party may, in like manner, deliver in duplicate to each of the said arbiters and to the agent of the other party a countercase and additional documents, correspondence, and evidence in reply to the case, documents, correspondence, and evidence so presented by the other party.
Okay, so they're basically laying out how much time frames they have after they've made the initial case and any rebutting and defense and counterclaims. So let's jump down to Article 5.
It shall be the duty of the agent of each party within 2 months after the expiration of the time limited for the delivery of the countercase on both sides to deliver in duplicate to each of the said arbiters and to the agent of the other party a written or printed argument showing the points and referring to the evidence upon which his government relies, and the arbiters may, if they desire further elucidation with regard to any point, require a written or printed statement or argument or oral argument by counsel upon it. But in such case, the other party shall be entitled to reply either orally or in writing, as the case may be.
Okay, so then Article 6.
In deciding the matter submitted to the arbiters, they shall be governed by the following 3 rules, which are agreed upon by the high contracting parties as rules to be taken as applicable to the case, and by such principles of international law not inconsistent therewith, as the arbiter shall determine to have been applicable to the case.
Okay, there you go. Here's the rules.
A neutral government is bound, first, to use due diligence to prevent the fitting out, arming, or equipping within its jurisdiction of any vessel which it has reasonable grounds to believe is intended to cruise or to carry on war against a power with which it is at peace, and also to use like diligence to prevent the departure from its jurisdiction of any vessel intended to cruise or carry on war as above, such vessel having been specially adapted in whole or in part within such jurisdiction to warlike use.
Okay, so they're kind of basically identifying the condition of the ship that is, you know, when it's being built by a neutral country, supposedly Britain, and what the expectations are as it cruises or leaves. And so, secondly, go ahead, and then thirdly.
Secondly, not to permit or suffer either belligerent or to make use of its ports or waters as the base of naval operations against the other, or for the purpose of the renewal or augmentation of military supplies or arms, or the recruitment of men. Thirdly, to exercise due diligence in its own ports and waters, and as to all persons within its jurisdiction, to prevent any violation of the foregoing obligations and duties.
Okay, so they're kind of laying out, you know, and this, if you look at this, these are the kind of the rules that have been adopted or carried forward for engagements when there was war in a part of the world. And so, like, when we started playing around in World War II, how we were sending ships, and we deliberately were sending ships with arms and so forth into World War II, where the Germans actually basically sank a couple of our ships. And so that's when we were dragged into the war, because we were belligerently saying and sending ships with armaments and so forth. So does this make sense, what they're trying to lay out, that this is the case, and then they're going to look and examine, did Britain do that? So, okay.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay, so Her Britannic Majesty has commanded her high commissioners and plenipotentiaries to declare that Her Majesty's government cannot assent to the foregoing rules as a statement of principle of international law, which were in force at the time when the claims mentioned in Article 1 arose, but that Her Majesty's government, in order to evince its desire of strengthening the friendly relations between the two countries and of making satisfactory provisions for the future, agrees that, in deciding the questions between the two countries arising out of those claims, the arbiters should assume that Her Majesty's government had undertaken to act upon the principles set forth in these rules. And the high contracting parties agree to obscene these rules as between themselves in future, and to bring them to the knowledge of other maritime powers, and to invite them to accede to them.
So there you go. So this is kind of laying out new rules of engagement when nations are getting engaged in war, whether they be neutral or what have you. So, okay, Article 7.
The decision of the tribunal shall, if possible, be made within 3 months from the close of the argument on both sides. It shall be made in writing and dated, and shall be signed by the arbiters who may assent to it. The said tribunal shall first determine as to each vessel separately whether Great Britain has, by any act or omission, failed to fulfill any of the duties set forth in the foregoing three rules, and recognized by the principles of international law, not inconsistent with such rules, and shall certify such fact as to each of the said vessels. In case the tribunal find that Great Britain has failed to fulfill any duty or duties as aforesaid, it may, if it think proper, proceed to award a sum in gross to be paid to Great Britain to the United States, to be paid by Great Britain to the United States for all claims referred to it, and in such case, the gross sum so awarded shall be paid in coin by the government of Great Britain to the government of the United States at Washington within 12 months after the date of the award. The award shall be in duplicate one copy whereof shall be delivered to the agent of the United States for his government, and the other copy shall be delivered to the agent of Great Britain for his government.
Okay. Now, it's going to go on and on and on and on. And bottom line, when we're looking at, you know, these all of these different articles, it just covers every step of this process. And so let's jump down to 18, Article 18. That would be XV111. Yeah. Yep, there you go.
It is agreed by the high contracting parties that in addition to the liberty secured to the United States fishermen by the Convention between the United States and Great Britain, signed at London on the 20th day of October, 1818, of taking, curing, and drying fish on certain coasts of the British North American colonies therein defined, the inhabitants of the United States shall have, in common with the subjects of Her Britannic Majesty, the liberty, for the term of years mentioned in Article 33 of this treaty, to take fish of every kind except shellfish on the sea coasts and shores and in the bays, harbors, and creeks of the provinces of Quebec, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick, and the colony of Prince Edward's Island, and of the several islands thereunto adjacent, without being restricted to any distance from the shore, with permission to land upon the said coasts and shores of islands, and also upon the Magdalen Islands. Is that how you say that? Magdalen? For the purpose of drying their nets and curing their fish, provided that in so doing they do not interfere with the rights of private property or with British fishermen in the peaceable use of any part of the said coasts and their occupancy for the same purpose.
Okay, so that's neutral ground. And so, kind of interesting that they're laying out this, because this is coming from which treaty? The 1818 treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, in other words, the Treaty of Ghent, which was passed, I think, 1816, when Madison was just retiring. So, apparently, there was another treaty that they created as far as trying to have amicable fishing and not to include shellfish. Well, we have shellfish today, but nevertheless, so they're pointing out that this is, they came to these agreements back in 1818 to do these things. Now, as I look at this treaty, one would think that there was going to be maybe fur flying or what have you. But when we get down to really the conclusions, we're going to find that there is really not that much, that there's not much here. And the point is that where is it? Where do we find the fact that the federal government began creating corporations? Where did we find this alignment between United States, Britain, and the Vatican? And so one would think, and as a matter of fact, in reading the Organic Act, the part of the document that you were reading, because remember you start at the top of the page and you didn't realize that the Organic Act was a little bit below that. So when we looked at the Organic Act, the preceding, well, we're going into break. So when we come back, I'll dive into what was preceding the Organic Act. But what's hard to find, folks, is, you know, the origins of what they've done. But there's no doubt in my mind that the Organic Act laid out the foundation for the federal government to actually create an operating government under and over it. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so going into the break, we were talking about what we read on Thursday, and that was the Organic Act. The Organic Act literally created a state government to govern the District of Columbia. And above that, we would have found that there were these authorizing the payments to Britain for the purchase of the Oregon, Washington, because that the Pacific Northwest was actually purchased from Britain. And as a matter of fact, I think that there was a move to try to go further north, but Britain kind of capped it there because they wanted to maintain Victoria Island and the people there in Vancouver. So anyway, long story short, there was this acknowledgement of the payment and so forth. And when people see these payments to Britain, they think, aha, we've got them. You know, this is where America's been subjugated. Well, we did buy land. We bought land from them, and we did that, you know, not as a subjugation, but that was in accordance with actually the procurement of the land so that we would be the owners of that. Now, what I'm getting and what we're going to find out of this treaty is this treaty is basically just it's a red herring. It is not, we're not going to find, you know, one would think that there would be probably more to this, but we're not going to find the aha. As a matter of fact, I think this is all, what do you want to call it? Being nice. I think that what we're seeing, and I don't know where you're going to find this, but there are people out there that talk about where this happened, excuse me, where the corporations and all of this happened. I know that the Organic Act was literally the foundation for actually allowing the government to start acting where they thought that they gave themselves the ability to create their own state and start functioning in an independent capacity, where the states never delegated that authority. So when we cover the ratification debates, we'll clarify why this seat of government was to be literally a no man's land, that it was owned and occupied by Congress and Congress alone, that Congress had this exclusive legislation for its maintenance, but it was not authorized to actually create a government. If that's the case, then they would have had to have gotten the amendment, because what the Constitution states is that Congress must use legislation in all things for everything that's there. In other words, only they had exclusive legislative authority over the District of Columbia. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And by creating a different government and delegating that and basically then empowering them to do things, it gave them the ability to start this governor and this new government to start assuming things that definitely were not granted to the federal government. And I believe it was shortly after that. And I have no idea when. So if anybody has the aha gotchas regarding the corporations, I do know this.
that from the Civil War going into the early 1900s, there were a lot of shenanigans being played by the different branches of government, Congress, the Supreme Court, and so forth. As a matter of fact, the Supreme Court was running rampant on redefining the 14th Amendment and basically playing its games with the law. And so I believe that they had gone so far because it was between the Civil War and the turn of the century where the, and actually I think we'll pull this in and we'll include this maybe, maybe as a part of this, I can send you a document that will give us kind of an overview of how corporations became persons when the federal government didn't even have the ability to regulate corporations or even create them. They had no authority given them to actually create any form of government. They didn't have the authority to adjoin to government. They only had the authority to basically oversee our importation, or I should say our foreign trade with other nations. They had the authority to go to war. They had the authority to, you know, end a war. And they started obtaining land and so forth because it benefited the Union. And everything else, those things that they started creeping and doing were just these little breaches in the Constitution that allowed, as they call it, a degeneracy and or what I'd call erosion, because as they do one little thing, it just starts eroding, and because they do a little bit more and a little bit more in association to those things. It's kind of like telling a lie. You know, you tell a lie, and then you come back, and somebody's asking you more details about the lie, and then you have to tell a few lies to cover up the lie, or additional lies to help, you know, explain the lie. Anyway, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, how things kind of go in a downward spiral when you start deviating or violating and breaking the law. So anyway, out of this and out of this whole thing, let me see if there's the conclusion in this, because they've got all the names, the treaty presented, arbitrated. I'm not seeing an actual outcome in this at all. And so I can, folks, there's no there here. And as a matter of fact, what we wanted to do was we wanted to try to open this up. And I've glanced through this. I've highlighted parts of this, but you know, it only lays out that they were trying to create this treaty that would have been. And here's the interesting thing. Maybe one of the things that you can garner from this, because if you go all the way back up to the very beginning, that this treaty does not identify a ratification process by the Senate. That in other words, when this is all being done by the individual parties, it doesn't say anything about the acknowledging the Senate's role in ratifying a treaty. That it's these people, these plenipotentiaries, they're the ones that are going to be the ones ratifying, along with the king, the president, or what have you. And I believe this is probably where they started going and changing how America was going to do its treaties. Basically allowing more latitude, because when we look at the treaties with the Indian tribes, most of those tribes did not actually do a ratify, or I should say, most of those treaties were not formally ratified by the Senate. In other words, the Senate, as they started, and it was right after the 1849-1850s when the Department of Interior was created, they actually just went ahead and said, well, whatever you sign off on, you know, we'll make it so. So, in other words, it didn't actually come back to the Senate for a two-thirds vote. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that way, everything would be done. And because what would happen is, you know, if the Senate basically had to play with it, and this became, I just want to say this was inherent in the political process, that when a treaty would be done and signed out, you know, in the West regarding an Indian tribe or what have you, and it came back to D.C., and there would be people that would want to, you know, fiddle with it and make changes. Well, you know, let's do this to this, and let's do this to that. And they felt it would be better to just allow them to grant the authority to Custard or whoever to, you know, create and sign and finalize a treaty. So when we really start looking, and they did actually do ratifications of main treaties like the UN and so forth, but I'm not convinced that all the treaties that have been passed were actually properly ratified. At least those with the Indian tribes, I know those weren't. And I think a treaty like this right here, I believe, because this is where the United States was trying to pursue a compensation out of Britain. And I'm not seeing anything out of here where the ultimate claim was actually addressed and what really came out of this. And so, supposedly, as I understand it, the United States demanded compensation from Britain for those damages that were done by those British ships operated by the Civil War, or I should say, the Confederacy. And so the British government, by aiding the creation of this Confederate Navy, and basically went down this path of, you know, I'll just say prolonging the war, because it prolonged the war for a good 2 years because of that. The United States was seeking hundreds, if not billions of dollars, and I don't believe that that was ever really finalized. I think there have been, you know, talk. I have no idea whether that was finalized or not. And so whether they actually came to a final conclusion on this, but you don't see anything in this treaty. At least as I'm looking through it, I'm not seeing anything where there was an actual award, a fault found, or what have you. And it just seems like, they spent a lot of time allowing these agents to basically examine a lot of information, supposedly. But I do not see an outcome for this. And so, anyway, I don't have much more to add. I'm kind of at a loss of where we can find, because what I'm trying to do, folks, is I'm trying to find that aha gotcha. Now, we know that they have corporations. We know that they're operating outside the Constitution. We know that they've created their own Constitution. We're talking about our federal government. And none of this is constitutional, but unless we can actually find the source documents, then I can't really pin as to when and how they did that, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was hoping, it was my intent to say that the Organic Act was the beginning, and that maybe this treaty and all these other things, these may have been smokescreens. I know, and there's people that talk about these documents, but I don't ever find source documents that point to this special treaty between Britain, Italy, or the Vatican, I mean, and the United States. So anyway, so I guess what that means is that unless something else really turns over, unless we actually, you know, find some other evidence that we can put to the side, because I think at this point it's probably more important to start moving forward regarding the ratification debates, because let me see here. Now, we've covered the Tory Acts. Now, we've covered the Articles of Confederation, and as well as the Articles of Association. Have we covered the amendments to the Articles of Confederation? I don't think we have, right?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right. So what we're going to do starting tomorrow is we're going to actually cover the Articles of Confederation's amendments. And the reason why I think it's important is because before we look at the Constitution, we want to look at the Articles of Confederation's deficiencies, because some of these deficiencies are really bad, glaring problems. In other words, most people think that in let me ask you this. Have you ever gone down the path of starting a business? Have you ever gone down the path of trying to create something, an organization? You have this idea, let's go do this. Okay.
Our business.
Okay. So not knowing. Now, if you've gotten a lot of help and so forth, you might have gotten, you know, the business established. But in many cases, 9 times out of 10, people don't see the things that they need to do because they, you know, they're just moving forward with this idea. And next thing you know, when they actually start doing things, they find out, well, we didn't account for this. And this is one of the reasons why 90% of businesses fail. Because there's really no good guide of, you know, crossing T's, dotting I's. These are all the things you need to consider. And most people don't want to take the time to, go down that path of being so thorough in creating a business. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at the creation of a cooperation, a business that is a cooperative. In other words, you've got multiple parties. It's not, you know, it's one thing for, you know, you and your husband or, you know, brothers or sisters to go off, form a business and start doing something. And 9 times out of 10, the successful businesses start with a success already. And I'll give you a good case in point. A business that is making, you know, let's say a couple of sisters are making cookies. And, you know, they're making cookies, they're doing so well that, you know, somebody comes along and says, wow, you know, you ought to sell those things, you know. And so they start selling them and they start making money. And over time, it really grows into this franchise and a trademark, you know, like Miss Fields Cookies or what have you. 9 times out of 10, those types of businesses, because they've got a product already, they usually succeed. But they getting from, you know, a cookie business into a global cookie business, you know, or if you want to call it a dynasty, whatever, to get to that level, it really requires people and or investors that are willing to, you know, come on board. 9 times out of 10, mm-hmm. I'll give you a case in point with networking. Cisco Networks. Most people have heard of Cisco routers. However, the people that originated the Cisco router system, this networking hardware, was a small company. I think they were in the Silicon Valley. They were just a small company, and they didn't know how to take it from this little small garage hobby shop into a global producing company. And so what happened was venture capitalists came in and they ended up basically transforming it and buying. They basically got bought out because mm-hmm. they didn't know how to get it from here to there. So they were given a good ransom for what they had created, but after the fact, when you look at what they walked away with, it was just pennies on the dollar compared to the money that Cisco has made over the several decades since then. So when you look at government, when you're trying to create a new government, 9 times out of 10, you have to make concessions because of politics, right? Because, oh, well, we don't want you to bring these things up because we feel bad. You know, we don't want to look bad. You know, we don't want to look bad that we're keeping slavery, so we just won't talk about it, what have you. And so the Articles of Confederation, as they started creating these things, you got to remember that these were created during the Revolutionary War. Now, I'm not sure how many people have tried to create a government while there was, you know, gunfire afoot and around, and you know, you're running around trying to keep from getting hit, getting shot, and, you know, being engaged with the enemy, so to speak. So to try to do something and to try to have cool minds in making, you know, the best decisions possible, you don't see that with the Articles of Confederation. And as a matter of fact, this is why we want to dive into the Articles of Confederation's amendments, because by shining the light on these amendments, it will help you, the listener, appreciate what they ended up going into the Constitutional Convention understanding. Because they realized that one of the amendments, and I'm just going to kind of be a spoiler here, but one amendment was that they did, the Continental Congress didn't have the ability to raise funds and to be able to buy pencils, paper, and administrative stuff so that they could do work. They didn't have the authority to do that. They actually, you know, it was expected for them to, you know, pay out of pocket. Now, over time, some of the things that they started realizing was they needed to start funding things and properly funding things. And that's one of the reasons why when we look at the Constitution, the compensation, there needs to be a person cannot be conscripted to serve government. I mean, if you're a prisoner or if you're a criminal, that's one thing. But if you're actually doing things and serving government, you can't be conscripted to, you know, I can't be forced to write, you know, what needs to happen. Now, if I do it on my own, that's one thing. But if somebody comes along and says, well, we need you to do this, then they're going to give you basic compensation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so that really flies in the face of the majority of Americans. As a matter of fact, most people, they get, you know, let me ask you this, instead of poisoning the water, how many people in Wyoming feel that the legislators are overpaid?
I don't know.
Because how often does it come up that they need a pay raise? And what do they get paid?
It's not very much.
It isn't very much. And as a matter of fact, every time the legislature says, you know, we need better compensation, everybody goes, you money grubbing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but when somebody goes in, you know, they say, I want to go in and, you know, start doing this. You either go in and you work good and you deserve a pay raise, or you go in with support on the backside that nobody sees, like lobbyists and what have you, where right, they start compensating you because you're doing good things for them.
Right.
So in other words, when we look at our government, and actually, when you look at a legislative body, these are the people that create the law. How much is it for the judges to interpret that law? Do they get paid? And how much is it for the lawyers who argue the law in front of judges? What do those guys get paid? Because these guys are the creators of the law. I'm just trying to create this picture that we really don't pay our legislators what they should be paid.
Yeah, it's not very much.
Right. But the problem is that they do things that they shouldn't be doing. As a matter of fact, it seems like the rule of thumb, that's a better word to use. The rule of thumb for a legislator is if you're not writing bills, if you're not creating law, then you're just worthless. And I honestly think that there should be seasons, plural, of sessions that pass by where really no law gets created.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, we're not they shouldn't be obligated to go and create law. They should actually look and go, do we really need a law? And if we do need a law, is that something we have the authority in the Constitution to do?
Yeah.
This goes into this, you know, because hey, folks, I've mentioned that, you know, government needs to sustain itself, right? And so when you create a government and you ask your government to do things that you don't have the money to pay for that. Look at Wyoming. How much money is Wyoming's government really costing? Now look at all of the things that it does, from healthcare, land management, all of these different things. I mean, how many people in Wyoming are on the government dole?
I think they say one out of every four people.
Okay, so
in Wyoming,
25%. So out of a half a million, that's 125,000 people. 1/4 of the population is a government employee or on the dole somehow. That's a lot. And so the question is, how is it that the people that aren't on the dole, how is it that the private sector can fund and afford a government like that?
Yeah.
I would look at when you actually have 1,000 households, and you know, how many households would it take to properly staff a sheriff's office? You know, for a sheriff to be able to drive around the county, to be able to, you know, have a good presence, to be able to protect you. What would that cost? And I'm just saying, you know, what would that, the burden of one sheriff on 1,000 households? I mean, it's probably pretty significant. And we need to be looking at what is it we need our government to do. So we need to know what kind of tax base you actually have to support that. Or you have to cut back on government. In other words, this is one of the reasons why we have a militia. This is one of the reasons why we're supposed to be defending ourselves. We're not supposed to have government doing it for us. And so when you look at a lot of the people, we didn't even talk about what's going on in Trump's office and so forth, how many of these people in these standing armies are getting laid off. They're given the, you know, walking papers and so forth because they're racking up too much cost of government. So when we look at where does Wyoming get all of its money to pay for its government? Do you know?
Oil, gas.
Actually, you guys get a huge stipend from the federal government, right?
Yeah,
because all of these little things, as a matter of fact, if I understand it right, and we need to probably look at that. I want to say 50%, if not more, it's coming in from the federal government in funding all of these things that the federal government is having you do. So the whole point is, and we'll pick this up tomorrow, the whole point is government needs to fund itself. And there's nobody can really afford boondoggles, but when you see your government doing boondoggles, that means that it's making way too much money off of you. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.